KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the 29th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park in Portland. This year, performers include Tedeschi Trucks Band, Dr. Joan and the Night Trippers, Maceo Parker, a Prince tribute with Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, and many, many more, plus two after-hours parties, dance competitions, six cruises, and 4th of July fireworks. This year, everyone will need a pass to enter the festival. Single-day passes go on sale June 1st, and early bird pricing has been extended to June 5th at 11:59 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, July 1st through 4th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016. I got my headphones on, just don't
like to wait. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Lost Boys of Portlandia, a film premiere gala and fundraiser for Outside the Frame, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Outside the Frame is a new organization that empowers homeless and marginalized youth by producing films with youth that convey their life experience. They will premiere The Lost Boys of Portlandia, a riff on Peter Pan, where real lost boys and girls debate if and how to return to mainstream society. They will also screen original film shorts by homeless youth about issues such as drug abuse, gender identity, and the healthcare system. Again, that's The Lost Boys of Portlandia, Tuesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I am a lost boy from Neverland, usually hanging out with Peter Pan.
And this is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01 a.m. And coming up, we'll be speaking with psychology professor Dacher Keltner about his book, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. At 9:35 or so, we'll speak with Douglas Soy of the Portland Underground Graduate School about upcoming events. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints. Domestic workers, activists, and cartoonist Lalo Alcala on his work. At 11, host Gene Bradley interviews writer Nathaniel Philbrook about his new book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. That's followed at 11:30 with an on-air broadcast of Progressive Spirit. Oh no, I'm sorry, Progressive Spirit host John Shuck speaking with leading Hinduism scholar Wendy Doniger about her book, Redeeming the Kama Sutra. And thank you to KBOO members for your ongoing support for KBOO Radio. If you're not currently a supporter, an active member of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Click where it says donate. And now, on with the show.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. My guest is Dacher Keltner. He is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the faculty director of the UC Berkeley Greater Good Science Center. He studies the science of compassion, awe, love, and beauty, and how emotions shape our moral intuition. His research interests also span the issues of power, status, inequality, and social class. He is the author of the best-selling book, Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and co-editor of The Compassionate Instinct. Today we are talking about his new book, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Dacher Keltner, thanks for coming into KBOO while you're in Portland.
It's great to be with you, Kathleen.
Now, you've spent over 20 years studying how people get, use, and abuse power. Can I ask you how you first became interested in the issue of power?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Kathleen. I was actually 20 years ago studying things like depression and anxiety how kids have trouble adjusting to school. And, you know, I do a lot of work looking at nonverbal behavior and how people behave. And when I looked at things like depression, it really looked like a form of submissiveness, right, or a form of a sense of loss of status. And when I consulted my literature, psychology, we had very little to say about how hierarchies and power and submissiveness influence the mind and our emotions and our nervous systems. And so 20 years ago, I began the research.
And what is the definition of power, and how did you come to that definition?
Well, what a terrific question. I mean, that was in some ways one of the hardest things to do, and it occupies the first chapter of the power paradox. So, you know, typically in the social sciences, and I think in a lot of people's intuitions, we think of power as money or fame or might, right? But that, for me, was not satisfying. It didn't really help us think about the power dynamics between a two-year-old and a parent, or the power dynamics in seventh grade, which are very powerful, or, you know, and I know your listeners will be thinking of this, all of the social change that happens by people who don't have money or might or political access. So I define power, and the field has moved in this direction, as a person's capacity to influence the state of another person. You know, and that influence can be with an idea, it can be with an act of compassion, it can be with money, it can be with force, but it really is about influencing the state of other people.
You make the point that it's shifting a lot of the time.
Yeah, and this is another thing. You know, we think, well, you know, I'm a professor at Berkeley and I'm powerful, right? And then I go home and I feel powerless around my kids, and, you know, then I move into another context and I feel. So one of the things that we really have to grapple with, and psychologists, this is what we do, which is to think about power not as a position, but as a mental state, right? As something that shifts from one context to another. And then the question is what does that feeling of power do to our behavior?
You've done a lot of research on this.
Yeah.
And I want you to use some of the examples of your research.
Sure.
If you would, when in answering some of these questions. But you do say that enduring power comes from empathy and giving. Can you expand on how people get power?
Yeah, this was one of the big surprises that I write about in The Power Paradox, Kathleen. So, you know, we have these stereotypes that power is really a kind of gained by Machiavellian strategies, you know, being manipulative and hiding stuff and deceptive and even strategically aggressive, right? But in actuality, when you study how people gain the respect of other people and power and influence, it's through empathy and more pro-social tendencies. So there are studies showing, for example, that from kids to people at work, that if you're good at reading other people's emotions, right? And we would study people, for example, kids in a summer camp or students who are just coming to college. And then you measure people's ability to read other people's emotions, empathy, and then you follow those people over time and see where they end up in that group. And they tend to rise in social power and their ability to influence others if you are a careful student of other people. You know, one of my favorite quotes about this is what Thurlow Weed said about Abraham Lincoln, probably our greatest president. He said, you know, the political genius of Lincoln was that he hears and sees everybody who come to him, right? He really respects other people and empathizes. So we learned in a lot of different studies that it's really your ability to connect to people and read them and think about them that predicts power. And then there's this other, you know, to your second point, there's this really surprising finding in the literature that is now being replicated in a lot of places, that it's really people who share ideas, encouragement, resources, opportunities that rise in power. This is, for example, robustly shown in hunter-gatherer societies, which I write about in The Power Paradox, where it's really the woman or the man who shares a lot of food who has the respect of the community, right, and has status. So empathy and kindness prove to be good ways to get power.
And there's some other elements, too, storytelling.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little
bit? Yeah, you know, that was another surprise, you know. You know, and again, it was fun to consult historical analyses of great leaders. And, you know, what you find is, like, Lincoln was a great storyteller, and his dad loved to tell stories and taught young Abe how to tell stories. And even though Lincoln was poor and awkward and a little unusual looking, he, in a way, won the presidency through storytelling. You know, we are a storytelling species. It's one of the basic ways in which we unite our communities, right? Older villages in many different parts of the world had individuals whose role it was to tell stories. Mm-hmm. Maybe even journalism serves that function today.
Right.
And so guided by that thinking that stories are so powerful and uniting and entertaining and teaching, right? Teaching about ideas that unite us. We've done a bunch of funny studies. You know, we did one study where we looked at kids at a summer camp and we gave them a chance to kind of do a funny story to kind of joke around with friends. And it was really the good storytellers who gained the respect of their peers later in that camp. We did studies of social groups on college campuses. And again, we let them kind of tease each other and joke around like people in a group do. And it was, again, the really funny, lighthearted, empowering storytellers who rose in power. And so I've made the case in the power paradox that this is just one of these powerful ways that we can gain the respect of other people.
And that reminds me some of the, in the book, you also mentioned the aspect of touch.
Yeah.
And how people related to each other and how that led to feelings about people and their relationship to power.
You know, as your listeners will get a sense of, you know, I take an evolutionary perspective toward, you know, how we get power and also other things I study like compassion. And, you know, when you think about those small groups in which we evolved, you know, for a couple hundred thousand years, power wasn't necessarily about your bank account or your control over, you know, Instagram. Rather, it was face-to-face stuff, right? It was just basic social behaviors. And touch is one of the most powerful ways in which we communicate with other people. It involves cells in your skin, which, and your skin is this, has billions of cells. It's 8 pounds of, you know, fascinating sort of systems that process information about who's around you. And touch is also really the first kind of way in which we connect to young babies, right, and other people. And there was a science that was emerging that shows, you know, if I pat you on the back, you feel rewarded, you feel comfortable, your stress system calms down. This is why touch is increasingly used in certain medical contexts. And you're more likely to trust me and to sort of collaborate with me. And so we've done a variety of studies. One of the most funny is, you know, we looked at teams in the National Basketball Association, including the Trailblazers. And we coded at the start of the season, how much are the teammates touching each other? Because basketball players have this great language of touch. And we found that the more that they touched each other at the start of the season with, you know, fist bumps and arm, or, you know, embraces and, you know, head wraps and so forth, the better they played, the more powerful they were at the end of the season. They're just more successful. So touch is this great language alongside sharing and expressing gratitude and the like that really gives you respect and power in groups.
So there comes a point in this book, The Power Paradox, where you explain what the paradox is.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Who's affected by it and how the seductions of power influence us?
Yeah. You know, and I know your listeners are like, God, you know, this guy, you know, he's from Berkeley, you know, and he's telling me that being kind and sharing and, you know, encouraging is good for power. And that is true. And I'm sure they're thinking, they're scratching their heads like, yeah, but when I think about, you know, Donald Trump or, you know, politicians or, you know, Johnny Manziel, you know, just time and time again, you see people in the news. I mean, you know, 3 people in Alabama right now, federal judge and or a Supreme Court judge and a governor in trouble for ethical violations. You know, what gives? Why? What are those guys doing or those people? And that's the paradox, which is that we do rise in power through really being empathetic and pro-social stuff, pro-social tendencies. But once we feel powerful or we come from a life of privilege, like a lot of our politicians today, right, where we're born into, you know, these very insulated elite lives, then you're likely to abuse your power. And, you know, Kathleen, we found this. There are hundreds of studies of this. One of my favorites that I profile in The Power Paradox was one of our first where, you know, we brought people to the lab. There were 3 people in a group. we randomly assigned one person to a position of power. And we said, you're in charge, right? And then they proceeded for the next hour to kind of write policies for the university and read stuff and, you know, do a group decision-making task. Halfway into the study, we bring in a plate of 5 chocolate chip cookies. Everybody takes a cookie because these are young people and they're hungry. All groups leave one cookie on the plate. So our key question was, who takes that 4th cookie? And it was the powerful person almost all of the time. And then what we did is we coded how they ate, and the person who was randomly assigned to a position of power ate with their mouths open, their lips smacking, and crumbs falling onto their sweaters, right? They're impulsive. And that then led to all of these studies that show that once we feel powerful or privileged or above others, we not only eat impulsively, we swear at people, we interrupt them, we're not as good at listening to them, we engage in inappropriate sexual behavior, we make, you know, sexual harassment, you know, we are more likely to cheat and lie in experiments. And even studies find, this wasn't our work, that people who are wealthy and privileged are more likely to shoplift. They're the ones who are taking stuff they can easily afford. So, you know, this is an old idea. Power corrupts, and it really shows up in lab experiments.
How do you make sense of these two ideas, this idea that, you know, you have this very compassionate kind of way that people get power, and then they get corrupted? Is it everybody that gets corrupted, or what? How do you reconcile those two things in the power paradox?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think that the reconciliation is to recognize that human nature is complicated, right? And these are just dynamic forces of, we are, in many ways, we're at our best when we're trying to integrate into communities and rise or gain respect of people. Let me give another example. You know, we've studied altruism in our lab, and who shares resources, one of the best things humans do, turns out it's people who are powerless and poor. The poor share more in our studies time and time again, because it's a way to build community, adapt, and gain respect. So this is just one of these complex dynamics in humans, which is we rise to power through what's good, and then very often power kind of unleashes what is problematic in human behavior. You know, it isn't inevitable. You can think of leaders who stay close to the practices that got them power and keep advancing the welfare of societies. You can think about people in your own community who use their power for forces of good. And that's one of my hopes of this book, is to say power is this energizing force. It can unleash a lot of action and make it for the good. And it really is quite simple, which is power tends to kind of orient your attention to your own self-interest. And the key to good power is to keep serving other people's interests.
I'm speaking with Decker Keltner. He is professor of psychology at the University of California, and he is the author of several books, including most recently, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. I wanted to talk about the issue of powerlessness, which you brought up a little bit more. You write about the price of powerlessness and how powerless people are affected in all kinds of ways. Can you talk more about the effects of powerlessness on people?
Well, you know, Kathleen, in many ways, the costs or price of powerlessness, which is the second to last chapter of The Power Paradox, was maybe the most important reason why I wrote this book. I had a really interesting experience growing up, if you don't mind my describing it. My mom got her PhD at UCLA, and we lived in a middle to upper middle class neighborhood, you know, when houses were affordable back then, and in Laurel Canyon. And then my parents in 1970 moved to a very poor rural town, because we wanted to live out in the country, in what was one of the poorest counties in California. And I had this really interesting experience as a 9-year-old kid, where, you know, I went from this kind of high functioning school, you know, with and then I went to this town, and the kids were great. The parents meant so well. People were so kind in my poor little rural town. But I kid you not, people were dying young. You know, there were people on my little lane of KO Drive who were dying in their 40s and 50s of weird diseases, who were really suffering poor health. And I didn't really think about it when I was nine. But then when I started to study power 20 years ago, these findings started to come in. And they were, I think, some of the most important findings in psychology. And the very simple finding is that, it was of Nancy Adler, that if you imagine a 10-rung ladder of United States, and then you put yourself on that ladder, so like I'm a seven, in terms of your status and standing in the country, what Nancy Adler was finding, and this is replicated dozens of times, is that for every drop down the ladder, you are suffering more from, you know, diabetes and heart problems and asthma as a kid. And you're, if you get a disease, you're more like, you die earlier, even if they have the same medical care, right? And that tells us that, and this was 20 years ago, wow, if I feel below someone, like my neighbors in on KO Drive in this little town, my health is really suffers, right? It's powerlessness. And what we then did, and a lot of scientists have joined in on that, is to try to figure out, well, why is that? Why? And what we've learned, and I think this is in large part because we're an more of an egalitarian species than today's economic conditions would suggest, that when I feel below people, my stress system goes on overdrive. When I feel the target of sexist ideas, and that is an attack on me, my stress system goes on overdrive. If I'm African American and the subject of somebody stereotyping, my stress system goes on overdrive, and then the stress system starts destroying your body.
Yeah, you say that something about reduced power gnaws at our nervous system.
It does, and you know, it's startling how powerful this is, Kathleen. So, you know, what the focus right now in the science is on the stress hormone cortisol, and we know from dozens of studies that if you have elevated cortisol, it elevates your stress and your cardiovascular response, and it starts to hyperactivate your digestive system and the like, and your immune system, and it wears them down. It wears down your veins and arteries and the like. So much so, there are studies now looking at little strands of tissue called telomeres on your DNA. And if I'm powerlessness or in a circumstance of stress and disempowerment, those strands start aging prematurely, and you lose, your cells start aging fast if you're powerless. And then the other focus in the literature is on something I study in my Berkeley lab, which is the inflammation response or a cytokine response, which is where your body has these cells that attack toxins in your body, like a virus, and your body inflames like you have a flu, right? And you're sluggish and sleepy and you have runny nose, which is part of the inflammation response, which is great if you have toxins in your body. But now we're learning, if I feel disrespected or powerless, or if I'm born into poverty, it hyperactivates that system. And that is bad news for your body's health. Mm.
So that generally leads to the conclusion that inequality is bad for society.
It is. And, you know, your listeners may have heard of a book, The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett. And, you know, there are just a lot of social biological scientists like me who are starting to just present data for the public to consider that this, that being below others, which is made worse by inequality, is really bad for your physical body and your health. And then I think it, you know, I'm hoping that policymakers will grapple with those data, mm-hmm. right, that are now worldwide.
When I first was reading your book and thinking about these issues, and I'm sure you get this all the time, in fact,
yeah.
about thinking about Donald Trump, for
yeah.
instance, and you you do have a line in the book where you say it's not a book about politics. So how do you talk about that these
yeah.
days?
Yeah. You know, when I wrote this, I don't know, it was 9 months ago or, you know, and Donald Trump was a blip on the radar screen. And, you know, and then he took the Republican Party by storm. You know, what we know, you know, this is not going to surprise your listeners, but Trump is a classic abuser of power. You know, and he's exploited people economically. He clearly is sexist in his language and his treatment of women. He is clearly xenophobic and really travels in the currency of fear and hatred, like Machiavelli did, who I critique in the book. And what we know, and I think we're already seeing really subtle signs of this, which is that that strategy, that very Machiavellian rise in power by instilling fear and taking other people down, like immigrants and Mexican Americans, that strategy impassions some people. And given a quirky Republican primary with so many candidates, he prevailed. But in the long haul, that strategy fails and disempowers. And I think it's a pretty safe prediction, and we're already seeing signs of this, that should he prevail, it will weaken the United States, right, internally. It already has. You know, when you look at the trust that is the fabric of our society, he's tearing it to shreds. And it'll weaken the U.S., as people like Joseph Nye at Harvard are arguing. It'll weaken the U.S.'s standing on the world stage. Other countries are already looking at us like, well, that's the end of that democratic power. So I think it's a disaster. Not surprising to your audience.
And so we get to the area of the path to power. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. I teach leaders of all kinds at UC Berkeley, you know, in my career. You know, and I'll teach people, school administrators and healthcare administrators and people at Facebook and Google and science who are running big labs and government and so forth. And they know the power paradox very intimately. And I would also say, you know, I teach parent groups all the time. And they start nodding their head like, yeah, this is my struggle with my four-year-old. You know, it's like we start getting into these conflicts and then, you know, I yell at them or whatever it is. And so what I try to direct the reader to in that last epilogue is a path to enduring power. It's interesting, you know, in a lot of realms, people have thought that power, this is an old debate too, like how I lead should be independent of ethics, right? And like power is all about getting things done and you shouldn't be guided by ethics. And that's actually an old Machiavellian idea. And I think it's an idea, for example, that governs Wall Street. Right, which is this is just about capital. We don't worry about ethical considerations to the extent that other places do, like schools. And I think that's a big mistake. What I write about in that last chapter is some of the ideas by which in every moment of your life when you're engaged in influencing others and being influenced, there are principles you can stick close to, like being humble and always recognizing your fallibility. And then it turns out there are new studies coming out that, you know, great leaders tend to be really humble. I also write about, you know, returning to a sense of sharing. You know, I think, you know, this will not surprise your audience. People who have a lot of economic power or one percenters need to think about sharing more, right, as a form of happiness and empowerment. So I think there are some simple ideas to redirect the course of our power.
Is that line of thought ever critiqued by somebody who doesn't have power, who wants to get power, you know, who is like an activist?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Activists working for an idea or for equal status or whatever, and they're hearing those things and they're thinking, well, that's not what I think that would just push me down, but it wouldn't get me the result that I'm really looking for.
Yeah, no, that's a very serious question, you know, and it is a question, you know, your more activist listeners should probably have is, does all this kindness, you know, and collaboration really work when we're fighting for justice? Mm-hmm. And I was worried about that too, you know, being somebody who volunteers and so forth on issues related to justice. But what I can tell you, you know, it's really interesting, Kathleen, as I was writing this book, The Power Paradox, there are these really interesting historians who looked at protest movements, right? And they were interested in like, how, if you don't have money and you don't have the military behind you and you don't have typical political support, how do you change societies? And this has happened over the course of history. And these are forms of political protest they've studied, you know, as like in India or Indonesia or the like, which are where you're really up against a violent military. Who wins? How, what's the strategy? And they looked at two kinds of protest movements across hundreds of historical examples. One is more violent, ISIS-like, you know, Machiavellian, like kill people, take hostages and the like, blow buildings up. And then the other is more collaborative, get the people out in numbers, right? Build up community, do the more peaceful approaches. And I already see you're nodding your head, but the peaceful approaches win, right? Uh-huh. They're more likely to get stuff done, more likely to change politics in those repressive countries. So I know it can seem counterintuitive that collaboration and kindness is a path to power when you're fighting against injustice, but I take heart in those findings. I'm sure some of your listeners have read Howard Zinn's A Power That the Government Can't Deny or something like that. That's this inspiring historical tour of all of these movements for social change. You know, obviously the civil rights movement, which began with Ella Baker and others, that really tells us that there is something to collaboration and building networks that's powerful.
At the end of your book, you say that carrying out the science that led to the book changed your view of wishing for a society that was power-free.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, when I was young, you know, I was raised and grew up in the late 60s and by activist parents. My mom is a, you know, very deep community activist. You know, I kind of had this early intuition, like power is a dirty thing, a dirty word, and it's pernicious and it's ruinous. And doing the science, I've come to the almost the opposite conclusion, which is that I want my daughters to feel powerful. You know, I really do. And I know they do because they're raised in a different era thanks to, you know, women before them and the feminist movement. And I want my students to feel powerful, you know, and I want the prisoners that I go work with in San Quentin prison, you know, in a restorative justice program to feel powerful. And I know that they do. Paradoxically, they're in one of the most oppressive institutions, but I know they feel like their voice gets out beyond the prison walls and it leads to change. So I moved, like you're saying, Kathleen, from this really interesting, like, well, I just wish we no longer had power or hierarchies, to the idea that, you know, let's empower as many people as possible, especially those for whom biases prevent their power, people of different racial backgrounds or gender and the like. So it was a really big switch.
Mm-hmm. And has this topic, has it led to another area of exploration that you're going to follow this with?
You know, so one thing is we are studying inequality and really getting into the nitty-gritty. And, you know, it's really incredible. We're finding a country's inequality hurts marriage and romantic partnerships. Mm-hmm. So the more, if you live in a county that's more unequal, you're especially those for whom biases prevent their power, people of different racial backgrounds. Finding that people feel more shame in unequal cultures. And that's tough news, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that we want to work on. We are really digging into inequality. And then the second thing is, you know, alongside this work on power and hierarchy, I always investigate emotions that help us live meaningful lives, like compassion, which I wrote about in Born to Be Good. And we're doing a lot of work on awe and the sense of wonder and amazement. And we are finding that awe, like especially what Portland has so much of, an organ of nature, restores your nervous system. So now we're taking inner city kids out on these trips with the Sierra Club and showing how beneficial it is. These kids have never seen, half the kids we take out on these trips had never been camping or seen a night sky. Mm. And literally one day of camping or rafting on these trips, you know, weeks later, their nervous systems look better. They feel more engaged at school. So very interested in thinking about how things like awe and kindness can be used to help people who don't get the breaks in society.
Thank you very much. I want to tell people I have been speaking with Dacher Keltner. He is professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He is also the author of the book we've been talking about, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. Dacher Keltner, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's been great.
And this is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. If you want to hear this interview again or miss part of it, You can hear it later today on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. And you are listening to KBOO Portland. This is KBOO's Public Affairs Programming. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. And now in the studio with me is Douglas Tsoi. He is the founder of the Portland Underground Grad School, otherwise known as PUGS or PUGS PDX. PUGS hosts their first annual Festival of Ideas on Saturday, June 18th. Sorry about that. Douglas Tsoi, welcome back to KBOO. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
I should say that Douglas was on KBOO before to talk about his book, Why Are Conservatives Always Wrong? But now we want to focus on his other work, which is the Portland Underground Grad School. I said you were a founder. Are you the only founder, or did you have a group of people founding that?
Yeah, it was just me.
And how did that happen? What was the idea behind it?
Oh, yeah. We started it, or I started it, about 18 months ago. And it was because I always wanted to go back to school. You know, every year it'd be something new. I'd want to get my MBA because I don't know anything about business, or, you know, behavioral economics sounds super interesting, so I want to go get a PhD in that. Or, like, you know, I don't feel like I have strong grounding in philosophy. But there was never any reason to go back to school and disrupt my life, number one. And two, like, graduate school is like $100,000. And so I felt like I didn't have access to education. And so I created the thing that I wanted. I wanted a free, well, not free, but like really low cost community education for my daily life. And I figured that there would be other people in Portland that wanted the same thing.
So how did you go about organizing it?
I just sent an email to all my friends saying that I would teach the first class, and I'm a lawyer, so I taught criminal law, how to think like a lawyer. And about 15 of my friends showed up, and I taught a four-week class on how to think like a lawyer, and then it just sprouted from there. People started suggesting instructors and offering their own classes, and we've grown to offering 5 or 6 courses a month now.
Mm-hmm. And how long are the courses?
They're 4 weeks long, usually 90 to 120 minutes per class, 4 classes.
And what's your attendance like?
We usually get around 15 students per class, which is perfect because that allows for a lot of dialogue, but also there's a lot of diversity of opinions in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. And is it structured any differently, the class itself, than the general graduate class? Or do you have thoughts on how it might differ just in how someone approaching it would feel in one of your classes as compared to how they'd feel in a academic setting?
Well, academic settings, I think, are pretty high pressure, and there's a lot of bureaucracy, and there are a lot of hoops and requirements, so there's a lot of stress. And I think the experience of PUGS is much more down to earth and enjoyable. It's education meant to be enjoyed and to be thought provoking, but not to put you under pressure.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little about some of the classes that have been offered besides yours on how to think like a lawyer, which actually sounds pretty interesting in itself.
Sure. I'll tell you about the June courses right now. I just started on Wednesday a course called How to Teach and How to Learn. But we got a bunch of courses coming up. And you can see it on the pugspdx.com website. But on Saturday, we have Walking Portland, History and Architecture. So the instructor, John Doyle, who is a lecturer for the Architectural Historical Society, is going to be exploring with the class 4 different neighborhoods in Portland and talking about the history of that neighborhood and the architecture there. On Monday night, we have Improvisation for Transformation, which is a class about how the practice of improv can be really deeply transformative for your life. You know, being present, you know, accepting all things. I've attended that course. That's really, really fun and wonderful because you practice improv.
Improv theater, improv comedy, yeah. Or
improv theater, yes. So it's a combination of practice and theory. So it's really wonderful. On Tuesdays, we're going to have Unlocking the Wisdom of Yoga. So plenty of people in Portland do yoga, the physical activity of yoga, but there are apparently 8 different limbs of yoga, and most people don't study the wisdom of yoga, the written Vedas. So Judith Sugg is going to be actually talking about, and you're going to be reading the actual text of yoga. And then next Thursday is a super fun class, which is The Importance of Wes Anderson. Mm-hmm. The instructor, Arturo Martinini, believes that Wes Anderson, he created the Instagram age. Basically, his films have created the idea of curating the visual part of your life. So we'll be watching Wes Anderson films and deconstructing what it means for the modern era.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm not that familiar with Wes Anderson's films, so I don't know how that actually applies, but...
Well, I mean, that's a super thing, super interesting thing, Kathleen. Like, I attend every class, basically, and a lot of the classes that we offer, I don't know anything about. And for me, that has become the real true education. Like, I go to every class, and because of that, my world has exploded. Like, if I had only gone to classes that I was interested in, I'd only learn the things I was interested in. And so I think that's one of the hidden ideas behind PUGS. Like, go to classes that you don't know a lot about, because that's where your world really opens up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. And what else have you learned since you've been, I mean, not maybe subject matter, but what have you learned about how people learn or how to structure a class, or what kind of things have you learned since you've been doing this?
I think this interesting thing is there are so many different resources in our community. And because we think of the education model as, you know, you have to go to university or you need to find, you know, some institution to teach you, a lot of our knowledge in our community is constricted. And once you open that up, you realize all these different people that you walk down the street with are reservoirs of so much information and so much passion and so much knowledge. That has been really revealing to me.
Hmm. I'm speaking with Douglas Soy. We're talking about the Portland Underground Grad School, otherwise known as PUGS, or PUGS PDX, and we're going to be talking about their first annual Festival of Ideas on Saturday, June 18th. And one thing I wanted to ask you, Douglas, was something about the community that you see as being built through these classes. Can you talk about how they build community?
Sure. I mean, I think of almost all of us really love learning, or we consider ourselves lifelong learners. And I think lifelong learning is one of those necessities and human rights. And I'm someone who has, you know, a stack of New Yorkers next to my bed, you know, 4 or 5 books that I'm supposed to be reading, like I want to read, but I don't have the discipline to do it. And I feel like PUGS is a place where people come because they carve out the time and the commitment to learn what they really want. And so that sense of community, that accountability to others creates the learning. I think, you know, I always say that PUGS is half learning and half community, and we take the community pretty seriously. We have this radical pricing strategy, which is an attempt to get everyone who wants to learn into our classrooms. So the radical pricing strategy, the first half of it is that the basic hourly wage in Portland is $15 an hour. So we price our courses to that hourly wage, $15 an hour times 6 hours, which is $90. So our course is around $90. But if you can't afford $90 for a class, we have a scholarship fund that will allow you to attend class at whatever price you can pay. And conversely, we ask people who make more than the Portland median income, which is $52,000 a year, to fund that scholarship fund. So it is people who can afford more supporting the people who are making less. And so that builds the sense of community.
How has that been working?
It's been great because I think people, it strengthens the sense of community when people in the class know that, one, they've helped other people attend and they're getting more diversity of opinions in the classroom. And then two, the people who are receiving scholarships know that the people in that class have helped them attend.
Mm-hmm. And where are the classes taught?
They're taught all around the city in community centers, sometimes in bars. We're underground, so we don't have our own space.
Right. Do the venues where they're taught know that you're actually conducting a class there, or are they underground to them too?
You brought up a new idea for me, Kathleen. Maybe I should just hold pop-up classes without telling people.
And do the instructors get paid?
That's the second half of our radical pricing strategy, which is after expenses, instructors get half of whatever we collected. So the basic idea is a lot of adjunct professors nowadays say that they're not being compensated for their knowledge. And so we wanted to make sure that we profited with and not profited from the people who were doing all the work.
Let's talk a little about the annual Festival of Ideas on June 18th. What is that?
Sure. Have you ever wanted to go back to school, but only for a day?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so PUCS Fest is basically people who would want to go back to school but don't want to make that commitment. It's on Saturday, June 18th. It's super cheap. It's $39. And the basic idea is that all the different PUGS classes create these small, beautiful little communities in 4 weeks. It's actually quite amazing, and it's wonderful. And we do things like we go out after the first class and the last class of each course to build community. And it's really gratifying to see the connections that people make after only 4 weeks. But I think the classroom does that somehow. But we have all these small little communities. And June 18th is a day that all the different little communities are coming together in one place. And all the different PUGS instructors will be doing presentations on the theme of time. So, for example, Peter Mark Bauer, who's the founder of Rewild Portland, is going to be doing a talk on the mysteries of prehistory. Wendy Willis, who's the executive director of the Policy Consensus Initiative, is going to be talking about facing death to creep towards justice. Justin Bury, who's an expert on landlord-tenant law, he's going to be talking about Marx and time. I'll be talking about the future of education. So all the different instructors are getting together, and we're all talking about time in our different disciplines.
Mm. And who can go to that? How do they find out about it? So is it open to anybody? How does that work?
It's open to anybody. And for KBOO listeners, I want to offer a discount code. If you want to register on the PUGS PDX website, use a discount code of PUTTY PUGS. PUTTY PUGS. PUTTY PUGS.
Is that all lowercase?
You know, I don't think that the case matters, okay. But if it does, use the capital P on PUTTY and all caps PUGS. But I think case does not matter.
Okay, great. And so that's happening June 18th, and then will that kick off what's happening in July? It amazes me that you do a new sort of curriculum every month. That must be a challenge.
Yeah, it's like being on the trapeze. Is it the trapeze? The high wire? It's the high wire, because we constantly have to put out new courses every month. Because if we don't make any money the next month, then we don't have any classes the next month. So you know, on one hand, it's really hard. On the other hand, it's what keeps us on our edge. Mm-hmm. We decided that 4 weeks was the amount of time that people wanted to commit to. Like 8 weeks, people wouldn't want to commit to. Ironically, though, at the end of 4 weeks, they always say that they wish the class was longer. But when I ask them, would you have signed up if it was 8 weeks? They always say no. Mm-hmm. So 4 weeks was the amount of time that we felt like we could build community, go deeper into learning, and also get people to commit.
Do classes ever have a second term based on popular demand, perhaps?
Yeah, we sometimes offer courses more than once, like Rewilding 101. Our Beauty and Aesthetics courses are a series. So you can go Beauty and Aesthetics 1, 2, 3. Our History and Architecture courses also are thematically around each other. If you go to the website, you can see that we have different subject areas, and you can actually earn an underground master's if you take 8 classes in a subject area.
Oh, interesting.
In UGMA.
It's interesting to me because I was involved in something here in Portland years ago called the Red Rose School.
Oh.
Which was, it was volunteer run, totally volunteer run. People taught classes on basically on radical issues, or radical history courses. It had a theme of that, but it has some of the similar ideas to what you're doing.
How did it go?
It went really well. I'm not quite sure why it went out of existence, but it went really well for several years.
What time period was this?
This was in the late 80s and early 90s, I would say. I taught a class. I was on the board of that organization, and I taught a class on the politics of appearance. And there were classes on Noam Chomsky. There were classes on various writers. There were all kind of classes. Our anarchism, it ran the gamut, but it was oriented around sort of radical ideas.
Kathleen, do you want to teach a course on the politics of appearance?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, you can think about it. That sounds fascinating, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's the really interesting idea of PUGs, that like there's all sorts of interesting ideas in people's heads, and this is a way for this to come out and spread in the community.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that what you're talking about was the explicitly radical nature of that group,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
We think of PUGs as a bridge between radicalism and mainstream. That it gives the mainstream access to radicalism, but also the radical access to the mainstream. So it's a really interesting space
uh-huh.
to be in.
So the radical access to the mainstream would be that there would be some mainstream elements that radical people would participate in, or how would that work?
No, I think about it more as like there are a lot of mainstream or radical ideas that can be talked about in a space that most people, non-radical people, would feel comfortable being in.
Okay. So have we not talked about that do you think is important to say about PUGs and what you do and what's coming up with this festival?
You know, I think one of the interesting things I think about is I was in a panel last night about alternatives to traditional education, and a lot of it was about online learning, like online courses or MOOCs. And I was trying to figure out, like, why would someone want to come to class? Like, if they could just sit at home and get a free course online. And I think a lot of it is we learn in community. Most of us learn in community. The analogy I would give is the gym, right? Like, there's some of us that, like, can exercise by ourselves and go on runs by ourselves. But a lot of us go to a gym because we need the accountability in the community. Like, it's a lot easier. I mean, for goodness gracious, some people actually drive to a gym to go to spin class instead of riding their bike, which I find hilarious. But there's an equivalent here somewhere for PUGs that, like, you know, we're embodied people. And so learning online doesn't give us the same experience. We're not in the same type of community. We don't get to interact with people the same way as when we look each other face to face, eye to eye.
Right.
And I think, you know, in the modern world, capitalism creates a sort of loneliness. And I think it's really, really nice to go somewhere where you can talk safely about ideas that really, truly matter to you with other people who are super smart and all care also. Someone told me one of the pieces of feedback I got was, this is a better thing to do with my evening than anything else. Like, it's better than Netflix. It's better than going out to dinner and spending money with my friends. It's like talking about things that really matter to me with other people is just the best form of entertainment.
Right. And do you think that in this particular age that kind of experience is maybe less common than it has been in the past?
Yeah, and I think part of it is, you know, we live in a city, right? We don't live in a small village where the community bonds are as tight. So this is an opportunity to actually have deep conversations with people. And people seem to really love it. It's like it's a need that we haven't articulated in ourselves, but once we experience it, it's multiple people say that the feeling they get from pugs is, and I haven't figured out what it really means, but deep satisfaction. After they take a class, they experience deep satisfaction.
I can understand that. Yeah. So I guess in our last couple minutes here, if you can refresh people's memory on where these classes are going to be, how they find out about them, and the fest, how they connect with you for that.
Sure. The easiest way to communicate with us is to go onto the Pugs PDX website. So it's PUGSPDX.com. And you can see the list of courses. You can see all the different speakers for Pugs Fest on June 18th. I'll just review again the June courses, and maybe I'll give a preview for the July courses. Let's see. Saturday is history. The Walking Portland, the History and Architecture course, which is a physical walking around Portland and learning about history and architecture. Monday is Improvisation for Transformation, so improv theater and what it can teach you about life. Tuesday is Unlocking the Wisdom of Yoga, which is the Yoga Sutras. Thursday is The Importance of Wes Anderson. Which is about the Instagram generation and how Wes Anderson created it. In July, this was one course that I really love to promote. We are having a course on your rights as a tenant. So, half of Portlanders are tenants. And right now, as you know, the Community Alliance of Tenants has talked about the rent crisis that we have. And so the Community Alliance of Tenants is actually teaching a course to people, and we're explicitly trying to recruit vulnerable populations and communities of color to come. And anyone who attends, we want them to go back to their communities and teach it to their communities. We want to spread the idea of knowledge of tenants' law, what rights you have under the law, to everyone. So that is in July.
And so, great. And so for getting in touch with you again, the website?
Pugs PDX.
And the KBOO password?
For Pugs Fest is Putty Pugs.
Okay. And I want to thank you, Douglas Soy. I want to thank you for coming in and talking about this. Thank you for your enthusiasm for this educational project. It sounds great. And I'll let people know that if they missed any of this interview will be on our website, kboo.fm, in an hour or so. Thank you so much for this, and best of luck.
This was really fun, Kathleen. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is Kathleen Stevenson. Stay tuned. Air Cascadia is coming right up. Thank you, Sam, for engineering.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th, to take place in locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence is an annual celebration of placemaking, community, natural building, music, and art. During the daytime, there will be 35 natural building and public arts projects to take part in. During the evening, there will be food, speakers, musical performances, and more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th in Portland. Information on project locations, performances, speakers, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Peacemaking and Connection, an experiential weekend workshop with 8 Shields PDX and John Young, taking place June 10th through 12th at the Cedar Ridge Retreat and Conference Center in Veronia, Oregon. The 8 Shields model provides a map to the principles and practices of peacemaking. Many conflicts can be avoided altogether, and conflicts that do arise can be managed with respect for all, with community balance and stability. Again, that's Peacemaking and Connection, an experiential weekend workshop with 8 Shields PDX and John Young, taking place June 10th through 12th at the Cedar Ridge Retreat and Conference Center, 18062 Kesey Road in Veronia, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.